From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In her new book, writer and academic Dr. Brittany Cooper shares the moment she was told her lectures were filled with rage, but that it was, quote, the most eloquent rage ever. It took some years for her to see her rage as a superpower, and she explores that journey to find her voice and focus her anger in the new book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Today, in the era of Donald Trump and the resurgent white supremacy that we're seeing around us, voices like those of Dr. Brittany Cooper are more important than ever. Here's a small taste. She writes, America needs a homegirl intervention in the worst way. So in this book, I'm doing what black women do best. I'm calling America out on her BS about racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, and a bunch of other stuff. Brittany Cooper is a professor of women's and gender studies and Africana studies at Rutgers University, co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective. She's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, Salon, Ebony.com, and TheRoot.com. She also writes a popular monthly column on race, gender, and politics for Cosmo. She joins me to discuss Eloquent Rage. Welcome to the program, Dr. Brittany Cooper.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, the fact that you owned this anger so beautifully in this book, and you have through your writings, I've been reading your writings for many years, I feel really inspires a lot of women in general, because women have been, of course, told that we're not supposed to be angry, but black women in particular, right? The idea of black women being angry, it's an ugly stereotype in this country. How do you take on this stereotype and demand that black women's anger is actually exactly what this country needs?
Yes. So I want black women to stop being dogged by the stereotype and stop allowing other people to weaponize it against us. And so part of what that has meant for me in my personal journey is owning that I actually am angry, and that anger is a legitimate political emotion in conditions of white supremacy and anti-blackness that are predicated on curtailing and eroding the possibility of black thriving. And so many black folks are in dealing with those conditions, those social conditions every day, particularly heightened in the era of the Trump regime, as so many other people of color are also facing and encountering in this moment. So we have the right to be angry. And one of the things that that encounter with my student who called me out on my eloquent rage did for me is to help me to stop pretending as though anger wasn't in many ways coursing through my veins, but also it allowed me to see that that anger wasn't diminishing my capacity to show up and do my work and do a good job. In fact, it was helping me to connect authentically to students who were not interested in professors performing a kind of detachment from the work. So she was looking for an authentic connection, particularly as a young woman navigating predominantly white institutions. I mean, I think when she saw my anger and felt it, that it helped her to feel like it was okay to be mad. And that didn't mean that you didn't have to show up and do a good job and be rigorous and be committed to your work. And so for me, that's what I mean in saying that it's a superpower, in that it is a regular kind of thing, but it can lead to extraordinarily great work in the world. And very often, women are taught to devalue our anger. And I also talk about growing up as a little black girl in a working class community where I saw my father, who struggled with addiction, really use anger in destructive ways. And so much of my personal journey has been about learning about the constructive possibilities of anger rather than seeing anger merely as a force that can destroy.
And yet the standard stereotype in popular culture of black women is that of the, quote, sassy black women. You have a chapter in your book that you opened with called The Problem with Sass. What is the problem with sass?
The problem with sass is that people often love it. Americans love sassy black women and, you know, get comic relief from it. But anytime I see black women being sassy, what I hear underneath that sass is a level of deep rage that black women don't feel the freedom to express. And so this is my way of saying to black women, someone sees you, I see you, we see you and understand that you're dealing with absurdity, often on the part of white people, but that it would cost you a lot to be able to call out that absurdity in the way that you want. So you've opted for sass and for comedy in order to get at it. And so this is my reckoning with white people, to interrogate what it means that you're so comfortable with the kind of attitudinal, sassy black girls, but that in laughing at black women who are sassy, what it often absolves white people of the responsibility of doing is really reckoning with the things that actually have black women angry in the first place.
Some of the problems with the idea of how we identify as feminist is that we tend to have very high standards. You know, unfortunately, people on the left in general, progressives, have purity standards. And one of the things that I love about your book is how you unabashedly see women like the Williams sisters as feminist, women like Beyonce as feminist, Beyonce in particular, someone who's polarized feminists, and even some black feminists who don't like her, to see her or think of her as being feminist. How important is it for us to understand that feminism is actually something that is that we, you know, should encourage women to self-identify as, right? Beyonce is a feminist because she wants to be a feminist.
Yes. Yeah, look, I'm over the sort of purity politics that are driving this moment. And one of the reasons I'm over it that I also talk about in this book is that I grew up as a conservative evangelical in the Deep South in the 1990s in this country. And that kind of purity politics is deeply harmful, particularly to women. Also, I want a politics that allows us to be in process. Like, hopefully what our politics can do is help us to clarify what the stakes are, rather than demanding that we be perfect, that we, you know, that we sort of engage in this kind of saints, sinners performance that really comes out of America's deep evangelical roots. And that's why I spend so much time talking about faith and calling it out in this book, because I think that that demand for purity from women actually is killing our politics. So I love Beyonce. I grew up on her music. I have been a fan of Beyonce since the very first Destiny's Child album in 1997. And, you know, so I want folks to know that I'm an old head in that way. Her journey has been really important to me. And I try to think about why Black feminists have such different responses to her. And what I actually come down to in this book is saying that some of it is kind of mean girl middle school trauma rising up around the fact that she's a beautiful girl. That she has privilege and power and visibility.
And she's light-skinned. Does that play a role?
Look, I talk about the fact that people don't trust that the light-skinned pretty girl can actually also be woke. And I think it's important for me to say that as a dark-skinned black woman, not because I'm caping for light-skinned girls. I absolutely am not. But what I am asking for is for there to be a level of integrity and thoughtfulness in our politics. And so that what we don't do is spend our time dismissing folks because of the boxes that we place them in. I see Beyonce is trying very hard to get out of those boxes and to not parrot the sort of worst stereotypes about what it means to be the pretty light-skinned rich girl. And I think that feminism is big enough to hold all kinds of black women, to hold all kinds of women across the spectrum, all kinds of women of color, anybody committed to doing the work, anybody that thinks patriarchy is a problem, that it curtails women's life chances and that it should be dismantled, should be able to identify under the banner of feminism. And that doesn't mean that we all have to do and live our feminism in the same way.
Do these sort of purity politics also mirror the kind of respectability politics that often we see coming from even within the black community and certainly outside the black community?
Absolutely. So, look, I try to have a nuanced take on respectability politics. I don't think I realized till I wrote this book how obsessed I was with the politics of respectability.
Define that for people who might not be sort of familiar with that term.
Sure. So respectability politics is, in particular in the U.S., a strategy that Black folks take up after the end of the Civil War as a way to argue to white people that we're human beings and that we should be respected and that our rights should be respected. And so it has everything to do with dressing properly, being very articulate, being well-educated. And so getting all of the sort of outward trappings of success as a way to compel people to see you as an equal and to respect you. And the problem with respectability politics is that if we're not careful, we can then start to say that the ills that communities of color face are because they are not respectable enough, rather than remembering that those ills are a function of white supremacy and capitalism and patriarchy.
So you said you've been struggling with this issue and obsessed with it for a long time. What has your journey been, and how have your views evolved?
Yeah, so look, like I said, I grew up sort of in a, you know, Christian family in the Deep South, working class, but also very ambitious and wanting to be successful, and wanting to get beyond the trajectory of my own mom, who I love, who had me when she was a teenager. And so in some ways, the respectability narrative worked for me. Work hard, be successful, go to school, be excellent at what you do, and the world can be yours, and anything that you want to achieve, you can have it. And that has been true for me in many respects. But what I noticed is that it was not necessarily true for all of the folks in my community. And I'm not interested in any kind of political ideology that only works for the few. If we say that what we want is to see broad access and entrance, and we want to see broad social thriving among all groups of people, then what we can't do is buy into an ideology predicated on exceptional Blackness, right? Or being a model minority as other kids of color face the sort of pressure to be. And so part of my journey around respectability is saying, yes, it worked for me, but no, I don't believe in it as a political project. And so what does it look like to actually get beyond the demands of respectability?
And you also write in your book about your deep admiration for the Williams sisters, who, you know, in many ways did all the right things to rise up through the ranks. You know, these two young Black girls from South Central LA who took over tennis and who just, you know, honed their craft to such a great degree, who followed all the rules, and yet time and again were slammed in the most racist way possible. How important is it for us to see their craft, their, you know, ruling of the tennis world as a very uniquely Black feminist project?
Yeah, look, I love the Williams sisters. And I love them because I grew up watching tennis with my mom. And so when they came along, I was like, who are these powerful Black girls? And what I love is their journey. I argue that in many ways, they are models of what I mean when I say eloquent rage. So when they came into tennis, they changed the game. Venus first and then Serena, of course, by asking, you know, by demanding that everyone be more athletic. They would chase down balls on the court that other people said were, you know, already gone and wouldn't have tried to get. And so they literally changed the way that women played the game of tennis, but they didn't do so without lots of mistakes. And so when they first came into the game, they had these amazing power shots, but they also had games that were rife with unforced errors because they hadn't figured out how to channel all that precision. And so getting to watch them over the span literally of 20 years, they have learned both how to be disruptive and to change and to change the game with their power, but now they have learned a sort of precise focusing of that power. And so Serena Williams, even at age 36, is simply unmatched in terms of what she can do on a tennis court because she has figured out how to corral the power in her shots into this kind of precision. And so growing up watching their game, being a huge fan of both Williams sisters and a little bit more so for Venus because we're the same age, I have looked at them and said, that is what I want to do. That early in my journey, sort of coming to terms with my anger, I too was messy and sort of all over the place. And so I had a lot of power, but often I used it in ways that were not particularly productive. And so much of my journey into sort of a grown woman kind of stance around my rage is to say, I have this power and now I have to focus it with precision so that I can land my shot every time.
Mm. Well, Brittany Cooper, would you be willing to read a section from your book, Eloquent Rage? Because it is, of course, quite eloquent, and I think it gives people a good sense of what the book is about if they hear you read a short section.
Sure, happy to do so. All right. In my 30s, I became an unwilling member of the Sisterhood of Fibroid Havers. Black women disproportionately struggle with fibroid tumors, and the medical science continues to offer little explanation. After my fibroid surgery, a successful outpatient procedure that I thought would buy me a little more time, my doctor, a lovely Black woman gynecologist, told me, more than likely, your fibroids will return. Perhaps the saddest part of being reminded of the dreaded biological clock was having to tell my mother that since I had no partner in sight, I might not be able to give her grandchildren. For the first time, I began to wonder whether I have whether I should have been less regimented and more reckless in my 20s when I was younger and had eggs to spare. Black women deserve more options than these extremes, that the same choices we make to not ruin our lives as young people become the choices that make us miserable 20 years later. Part of what friendship has meant in my 30s is supporting my homegirls in their 30s and 40s who have limited partnering options and even less options for starting families. The intimate consequences of all these good-ass choices we have made are relentlessly brutal. Yes, folks are quick to say, adopt, freeze your eggs, try in vitro, but with what money? Black women in prime child-rearing age have negligible net wealth. Many of these single women who are first-generation middle class like me with loads of educational debt and without a two-income household have no way to fund a creative family structure. The weight of the absence, of the partners who didn't show up, of the children you didn't get to have, of the uterus robbed by boys, is a burden none of us was properly prepared to bear. The unfair part is that folks are far more concerned with policing how Black women carry the baggage than with reducing the load hoisted upon us in the first place.
Brittany Cooper reading from her powerful new book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. So the section that you just read is not one that we usually discuss. This idea of women's choice, women's reproductive rights rarely veers into the struggles that women in general, and then as you point out, Black women in particular, have to have families if they want them. How important is it for us to discuss that openly? Are there enough options that are financially viable for women?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to talk about it because when I say rage, I don't want to perpetuate this idea that Black women are invulnerable, even when I want to own it as a superpower. So what I want to say is that one of the things I'm mad about is, and one of the cost of respectability politics in my life has been that I was so obsessed as a teenager and as a 20-something with being perfect and with making all the right choices. So with not having a baby before I was married, that when I arrived in my 30s and the partnering options didn't show up, and then suddenly I found myself post 35 without a permanent life partner and without the kinds of prospects that I had desired around having children, that's an anger-inducing thing, and it's not something that's singular to my own journey, but we're seeing a whole professional class of Black women who are struggling with the fact that we made all the choices that America demanded of us so that we wouldn't be stereotypical Black women, and now that we are adults and we have great careers, that hasn't necessarily translated to us also having the family lives that we want. And then folks sort of say to us, well, you can have a kid any way that you want to. You don't just have to be partnered in order to have one, but it takes money to be able to freeze your eggs or to be able to, you know, get in vitro fertilization and all of those sorts of things. So people often aren't grappling with the fact that all of this intersectional sort of power structures that we talk about in feminism, they have intimate consequences. And many of us who are women of color are living out those intimate consequences of these intersections daily. Mm-hmm. And so we need the space to be able to own that this is what we're angry about, that even when we made the right choices, the choices that everyone told us we should make, that we still didn't always get the return on investment. And we're angry about that, but more so than being angry about it, sometimes we are hurt and sad and devastated that our good choices in our 20s have become choices that feel like a burden in our 30s.
Brittany, how important then is it for us to bring up the fact that the rage that women feel can be focused and can actually lead to good outcomes, but how do we envision this better world? How do we put that anger into the right use? I mean, you're using your anger, you're speaking out. There is a lot of anger among all different kinds of women, different levels of anger. How do women channel their anger so that those ways in which we are hurt don't have to be repeated in the next generation?
Yeah. So one of the things that I would ask women to do as a gut check that when you feel most angry, try to think about what is the thing that you feel powerless about that is driving that anger. And then think about don't say to yourself that you don't have the right to be angry, but rather say, well, what is the thing that I can build that I don't currently see and that I wish I had? And so for me, one of the things that I could do, I can't just magically sort of make money and children and partners appear in my own life. But what I can do is tell the story in a way that helps other women to not feel so crazy. I mean, it's been so powerful to be in conversation around this book and have so many women say, I feel seen. And, you know, and to say that, you know, they haven't heard other people telling the story in a way that feels empowering. And so this has been my attempt in using my voice to try to build a version of the narrative that I think is sustaining. And I would say that to women, that one of my big parts of my journey has been understanding that anger doesn't always have to be about destruction, but that it can be about what is the world that we want to build. And so I see that kind of anger rising up when you see 3 million women getting in the streets after the election of Trump and saying, this is not the world we want. And now you're seeing women, the rates of women running in elections, particularly in local and state races around the country, has surged astronomically over the last year. And that's a commitment to using one's rage to build a world we want to see.
I want to talk about the word empowerment. As you write in your book, it's a tricky word. And, you know, certainly one can say things like your book, Eloquent Rage, is very empowering for women. And we mean that in the best way. But you write, it's also a decidedly neoliberal word that places the responsibility for combating systems on individuals, right? And so we have the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world telling women to simply lean in. So how do we reframe the idea of empowering, not as an individual act, but as a collective one?
Yes, thank you for that question. So one of the reasons that I have been so invested in challenging the notion of empowerment is because the folks who need empowerment, so we mix up empowerment and power. And what I'm arguing in this book is that women need power and women deserve power. And power is the thing that changes social systems and social conditions. And empowerment becomes this individual thing that is about fixing oneself and fixing one's own deficits. And I don't think that the politics of empowerment are bad. It's just that too often we mistake our personal empowerment for what it means to have real, actual power to change the world. And so it's not just enough for me to be able to tell my story. That would be me being empowered. But what I actually want is a world where when Black women make the choices they make, those choices actually create a set of conditions for them to live and to thrive, to have the families that they want, to have the kind of careers that they want, to be impactful and at the same time fully human in the ways that they want. And in order for that to happen, something has to shift in terms of the power structure. And so what I advocate for in this book is not, is not disparaging those of us who want to learn more to be empowered. But what I hope women see my book as is a tool to equip them, as a tool that they can place in their arsenal as they figure out what their own superpower is and how they hope to channel.
Finally, I want to talk to you about the importance of Black women in American society in general and how we maybe as a country need to start seeing what Black women do as part of the forefront of progress. Many argued that it was Black women that showed how it was Black women that overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election, more so than any other demographic, because they knew the dangers of Trump better than anybody else. It's the three Black women founders of Black Lives Matter that have, and so many of the women in that movement, movement for Black Lives, that have drawn attention most effectively to the police brutality and violence in aimed at African-American communities. How important is it for the country as a whole to recognize this very specific demographic of Black American women as essential to the future of this country?
So one of the things that I believe and that I talk about in this book is that the reason that we should follow Black women's lead is that white women and Black men have a particular set of shared challenges. And what it is, what those shared challenges are, is that both Black men and white women have such close proximity to white male power that often visions of freedom are limited by their desire to have a sort of level of access and power that white men have. But Black women are not a politically pure category, but structurally, because we don't have any level of proximity to white male power, we have had to imagine a different way that freedom looks like. What is it? It means something very different if you're a Black woman and you don't have access to male power and you don't have access to racial power. And that broader vision of freedom is fundamentally more inclusive. When you ask Black women, we see and believe in the ability of the American project lived out on its best terms to actually be in a community that is inclusive of all different kinds of people, and a community where any group of people who is willing to show up and do their work in the world based on their capacity can live and thrive. And so that is why you see Black women voting in the way that we do, because we can see a disaster coming, because we have had such proximity to seeing white supremacist disaster and patriarchal disaster. But also we have a broader vision because we are often tasked with the labor of making sure that the least of these in our communities, little children, the elderly, folks who have disabilities, actually have the things they need in order to be okay. And very often men are not tasked with that labor. And depending on their positionality, often white people in the aggregate are not tasked with that kind of labor. And so that's why I'm arguing that Black women are a trustworthy political class, not again because we have some inherent innate sense of moral purity, but rather because what we have is a perspective granted to us by being at the intersections of race and gender that allows us to see that a different kind of world is possible. And not only is it possible, but that it is absolutely necessary if we want a different kind of American Freedom Project to show up.
Dr. Brittany Cooper, I am very grateful for your eloquent rage. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brittany Cooper is a professor of women's and gender studies and Africana studies at Rutgers University, co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective. She's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, Salon, Ebony.com, TheRoot.com, and more. We've been talking about her new book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.